Hello, and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with baseball writers and authors, artists and musicians, filmmakers, basically anyone who has anything to do with baseball and pop culture. Because that's our slogan. If it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. This is how I start off my review of Seeing Home, the Ed Lucas story, a blind broadcaster's story of overcoming life's greatest obstacles, by Ed Lucas and his son Chris, on the May 9th edition of BookReporter.com. These days, the word inspirational is tossed around for a lot of things that really aren't. But in the case of Ed Lucas, it somehow doesn't seem adequate. I'll provide a link for the rest of the review on the site. As many of you know, when it comes to celebrity memoirs that are written with the assistance of another writer, it's often the latter in whom I'm more interested. What was his or her role? Was it to sit passively by while the celeb talks and basically transcribe, perhaps punching up the grammar a bit? Or do they interview the subject and then write it up? And what if, as in this situation, you have a strong connection with the subject? Do you just let them do their thing, because this is their memoir? Or do you interject your thoughts and comments, and perhaps change the rhythm and meaning of the narrative? These are some of the questions I asked Chris Lucas in our bookshelf conversation.
Chris Lucas, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Thank you.
Well, congratulations on this book. It's receiving great fanfare. It's being hailed as extremely inspirational. How did this project come to be?
It's been long in the making. I like to joke that I've been living it for 45 years and writing it in my head for 20, so putting it to paper was something that my father and I have been thinking about doing for a long time, and the timing was just right last year. We had a window where we both could get together and do it, and we were lucky enough to, you know, we pitched it to a bunch of publishers, and Simon & Schuster bought the rights, and then shortly after that, they came to us and said, hey, there's a guy that just retired. He wants to get into publishing. He wants to work with you, and we were thinking, oh, great, you know, some recently retired guy, and it turned out to be Derek Jeter, so we couldn't have asked for better timing for everything to come together. And like you say, it's been well received, and we're very happy about that.
Now, this Jeter Publishing is obviously a new venture for him. Did you work personally with him? Is he involved in his imprint?
He has been more hands-on involved than I ever expected. You know, a lot of times when guys like Michael Jordan or Magic Johnson or people like that, or even former retired baseball players, they start a company, it's a name only. They lend their name to it, and they let other people run it. But I have to give him credit. Derek Jeter, from the very beginning, he's either phoned in on meetings or he's been there personally at meetings. And last year when we were at the ballpark, he came up to us every single time my father and I were at the ballpark. He would come over, and, yeah, I've known him for 20 years, and he's always been friendly, but sort of, you know, his reputation, he's just sort of standoffish. He doesn't really try to get close to too many people. But he would come up to, hey, Chris, how's it going? How's the writing going? He was very, very hands-on, and he wanted to know every step of the way. He read sample chapters. He gave advice. So I have to thank him for all that he's done.
Now, this is a bit of an unusual project. I basically follow baseball literature. I don't know the rest of the celebrity world, but for a family member to collaborate on a project like this, that can't be very easy.
It's an interesting concept. You know, I recommend it highly for anyone to sit down with their parents or their grandparents, or even if you are a parent, to sit down with your children. And it was a great feeling for me to be able to share these stories with my father. And many of them I heard before, but I learned a lot of new things and heard a lot of great new baseball stories. And I would prompt him about different players and different people through the decades, and it got his memory going. So it was quite an interesting thing from father to son. It's different. It would have been a completely the story would have been told completely different if it were another writer writing it with him. So it's, you know, it's hard to keep out the personal aspect of it. And someone, there was a critic that commented on that on the other day. They said they could really tell it was a personal story done by a father and son. It didn't read like something that was sort of academic or baseball history. So, you know, there's good and bad in that, but I think there's more good.
Well, I mean, this obviously isn't an academic book. I mean, I don't think you can hold it up to those kinds of standards. But because it was such a personal project for you? I mean, you learned things about your family history that you didn't know?
Oh, I did. I think the biggest one, the most shocking one that I learned was that my dad is blind, and he was struck by a baseball when he was 12 years old, and that's what led to his blindness. And that was back in – it was actually the day Bobby Thompson hit his shot heard around the world. So back in 1951, medical technology wasn't what it is today. So I had heard all the stories about how they tried to fix his eyesight. But the one I didn't know until we started writing this book was that both of my grandparents went to the doctors, and they each offered to have one of their eyes cut out to give to my father so that it could be transplanted so their son could see again. And when I heard that, I mean, I'm a parent now, and you want to do all you can for your children, but that's just shocking. That's something that goes above and beyond. So it was little things like that that I learned more about my grandparents and more about the rest of the family, not so much about my father, but about the other people and how his life affected theirs and how they had an effect on him.
Now, I do have to point out the irony in that the stage was set for him losing his sight on a day known as the shot heard around the world.
That's true. You know, you're the first person that said that, and even my father, I don't think, has ever commented on that. So I give credit for that. That's an amazing observation.
One of the things you mentioned in the book later on is people asking him the cliched questions: are your other senses heightened by the loss of one, in this case, sight? And evidently, your father dispels that fallacy.
It is a fallacy. It's one of those, again, it's popular culture, popular myth. There's a show on Netflix now called Daredevil, and it's about the superhero that his senses are heightened after an accident. So a lot of people over the years, there are a lot of myths we dispel. That's one of them, that the senses are heightened. The other one is that you can feel someone's face and get a picture of who they are. You know, not only is that unsanitary, but it's also, it doesn't help a blind. My father understands who people are by listening to their voice, and then he creates a mental image that may or may not look like we see the people, but in his head, that's how they look. And he was fortunate enough, he didn't go blind until he was 12, so he has images in his head of what a baseball field looks like and what certain players, like he would always say to Mickey Mantle, even till Mickey Mantle was in his later years, he would say, "You look to me like you did in 1951, you know, the blonde-haired guy, the chiseled muscles." And Mantle loved that. Every time he said, "Come on over here, take a picture with me, because I know in that picture I'm looking like the guy from 51. So there it's good and bad to it, but he certainly, some of his senses are heightened. His favorite trick is he's able to tell, which is amazing. He can hear from the crack of a bat how far the ball is going. He can tell from echolocation how far it's going and where it's going. So he can usually tell a home run the second it's hit when we're in the ballpark, or if it's, you know, a pop-up or a fly ball, and which direction it's heading.
Now, if he did not know who was at bat, would he be able to tell from the sound who might be hitting the ball?
There are people, yeah, because he covers the Yankees a lot, he's really good at it. He was with Don Mattingly, actually. There was an instance, and I don't think we put it in the book, but Mattingly told this story the other day to a Los Angeles station about my father, that it was in the mid-80s or something, and he was in a slump. And my father went to him in the clubhouse and said, "Don, something doesn't sound right." And he said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, just something off about the way your bat is hitting the ball." And Mattingly brought my father to batting practice and said, "You tell me when it sounds like it used to sound like." And he did it for about 20 minutes, and finally my father said, "That's it, right there, that one." And Mattingly corrected his swing, and he started hitting again. So, you know, there were other things he did to help himself, but that was one of the things my father contributed to that, because he said the sound of your swing is different than a lot of other people.
That's fascinating. Just to get back to the myth of the accentuated senses for the blind person, I just happened to see a television program a couple of days ago in which there was a blind girl who asked to feel the face of someone so she could identify him. And, you know, it brought me right back to what your father had written about, you know, not being able to do that.
Sure. And a lot of it's also personal. You know, people ask my father, why doesn't he wear sunglasses when every other blind person? Well, not every blind person wears them. Some people, they choose to wear them for comfort or for, you know, if they've got an accident where their eyes are a bit disfigured. So not ever, but people see them and they say, "Oh, you're blind. You're supposed to have sunglasses," like Stevie Wonder and Ray Charles. And so there are a lot of things, again, that people expect of blind people that don't always line up to reality.
Is your father musical at all?
Certainly not, no. I've stood next to him when he tries to sing the national anthem, so he's got a lot of great abilities. Music ability is not the best.
So in the back-and-forth collaboration effort, were you – I mean, you both live in Jersey, correct?
Yes.
Were you always sitting down together to do this, or was there, you know, people put stuff on recording for you to work on? How did that work?
The process was we actually had 3 months to write it. By the time we signed the contract in January, and they wanted a finished draft in April, and all we had written was a proposal. We didn't even write any chapters yet. So within 3 months, we had to get it all down. So that was about 12 weeks, and we knew it was 12 chapters. So what I would do is I would sit with my father at the beginning of the week, Sunday or Monday, and I would say, okay, this chapter, this particular one, takes us from 1951 to 1957. And I would do a little research, look up who were the famous players of the day, what were some of the celebrities, the news stories, and I would just prompt him. And I would say, aside from your own personal stories, tell me some of the things about how you reacted to this in the news or that. And from that, it kind of triggered his memory. And so I would take all my notes on a Sunday or Monday, and then I would just go back home and somehow distill that into a chapter. And I'd say 80% of what we talked about is not in the book, and there were some great stories. So, look, hopefully that'll lead to other books in the future. But, the process turned out to be great because there was stuff that there, and there were people, you know, stories about Bob Gibson and other guys that he had almost forgotten until I said, well, tell me a little bit more about Bob Gibson in the beginning. And then he started to recall a lot of the things that had happened. So it was great for both of us to do.
And it's funny you mention that. As I was reading the book, I said, gee, I wish there was more stuff about this or more stuff about that, especially when he's talking about, you know, what it was like working. I mean, he was there was a lot of discrimination against him.
There was, and one of the things I mentioned, Bob Gibson, one of the stories that our editors cut out of the book because they said it was sort of repetitive. We'd already had a bunch of stories, which fascinated me, was my father had an audition for, I forget the station, but it was a Philadelphia television station, and they wanted him to come down and audition on air to be one of their on-air people, knowing that he was blind. So they were giving him a big shot, and he went down to Philadelphia, and none of the Phillies players wanted to talk to him on field. They had a camera crew and everything ready, and all the Phillies kind of walked in. This was early on, so it was the early 60s or so. And it was Bob Gibson who came over and said to my father, barely knew, I think he had met him once or twice, and said, Ed, you need someone to interview? And he was at the height of his career, just starting out, you know, he was a big, huge player. And he did a 15-minute on-camera interview. Now, my father didn't get the job, but the fact that Bob Gibson took the time to come over to this rookie reporter and say, you know, I'll do what you need me to do, forget about all the other guys. And it was moments like that that I think meant the most in my father's career early on. And there were several others that we did put in the book. But one of the things that struck me in reading it, and it wasn't until the second or third time that I read the draft as it came back, was I realized early on a lot of the players that connected with my father, Willie Mays, Jackie Robinson, Bob Gibson, these were mostly African-American players, mostly players that had to cross their own barriers and face their own struggles and discrimination. And I think they sensed that same thing in my father. And, you know, maybe I'm making a leap here, but it certainly, they were the ones that reached out first before anybody else.
Now, conversely, as a blind person, your father can't make any snap judgments about anyone he meets because he can't certainly base it on the color of their skin or well, I was going to say gender, but I guess it's easier to tell gender apart than it is.
Well, race. Even then sometimes it's
well,
a little hard.
Yeah. But as far as the race goes, that in a sense, benefits your father because he can make any kind of immediate judgment based on that.
It does. What he likes to say is that he can tell how a person is feeling more than who, you know, what color their skin is, things like that. He can tell when a player is lying to him or they're not, you know, they're not being entirely candid or there's something wrong or something's going on. He really gets, that's what really sets him apart as a reporter. The question we've been getting over and over again is how does a blind man cover baseball? Obviously, he doesn't do play-by-play, but what's kept him going all these years in his career is that he's able to get players to open up to him because he can say to them, look, you know, is there something going on? I hear it in your voice. And then they just start telling him the story. And that it really changed in the mid-70s. That's when players started trusting him and opening up to him, and the floodgates opened after that. So he's been fortunate that there's so many people in baseball, Hall of Famers, ordinary players, who have become close friends of his because of that.
Now, you mentioned the experience took place with Gibson in the 60s. I wonder if that goes far enough back. Baseball players are a very superstitious lot, and they don't like coming across items that make them feel uncomfortable. So I'm wondering if that has any kind of effect they had on him. But I want to ask, were there any writers or reporters who were especially helpful to him during his development?
There were a lot of the early on. He faced what he calls in the book the old guard of reporters, the guys that had been around, you know, on the train with Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig. They were still there at the end of their career when my father started, and those guys gave him a hard time. They all said, "What's he doing here? He shouldn't be here. He's handicapped. Because he needed a guide, he would have two places in the press box." And they'd say, "You know, that's two guys that could be working, and this guy's taking their spot." So it wasn't until newer guys like a Bill Madden and Phil Pepe and Maury Allen and people like that, they started coming in. They were sort of the rookie class that came in with my father, and they respected him for the work he was doing. They didn't care that he was blind. They didn't care all that. They just they saw how the players responded to him and how tenacious he was at getting stories, and he was doing what they were doing, and they said, okay, here's a guy. And as far as broadcasters go, guys like John Miller and, you know, former players like Bob Uecker, Al Michaels, who worked for the Giants for a while, they all responded to my father in a great way as well. So it wasn't so much the old guard, it was the newer ones that came in the 60s and 70s, who now I guess are the old guard, but they really welcomed my dad.
Since it's you, his son, working on the book with him, was there anything that he brought up that you particularly didn't want revealed in the book?
I think the only decision we made that was a conscious one was there's a lot of, just the nature of being in the clubhouse, there's a lot of dirt that he dug up, or a lot of stories that he could have told that would have painted people in an unflattering light. And very early on, we said, okay, we're not going to do that. We're going to try to keep it as positive as possible, because his story is an uplifting and positive story. So there were instances where we could have definitely dragged some players to the mud and broadcasters, and I said some of those old guard reporters. We could have named names. And, you know, I suggested it to my father. Human nature is you want to settle a score. And I said, listen, let's not do that. Let's just keep it in a good frame. So we do make allusions to certain people, but we don't give any names in there.
And it's certainly, in a sense, a spiritual book. There's a lot of reference to his faith. And that certainly goes toward that, you know, propping up that faith, you know, the declaration,
right,
not to smear other people, which is very admirable.
And a lot of that is Derek Jeter, too, because when we pitched this book initially, we went to 10 different publishers before we got to Simon & Schuster, and all of them said, y'all get all that faith stuff out of there. You know, make it just a baseball book. Make it a funny book about all the stories in baseball. You don't need, and many of them said, oh, put in some of the negatives. You know, we want to be able to sell that to a magazine that Ed Lucas, talks trash about this player or that player, or hear what they did to him. And we said, we're not going to do it. So we kept moving from publisher. And finally, when we got to Simon & Schuster, they said, no, we think it's great. And Derek Jeter, to his credit, said, put even more of that in there. He said, that's who you are, Ed, and people need to know that. So he encouraged us to add even more of the faith stuff and even more of the positive stuff.
I think that's a reflection on his upbringing.
Yeah.
What about your brother? Did he have any involvement in the book?
He did. He's sort of the silent partner in the whole thing. I have an older brother who's a year and a half older than me, and he doesn't seek the spotlight as much as my father and me. I'm a performer. I'm an entertainer. I'm an actor for a living, so I'm comfortable doing radio interviews or being out there or doing television interviews, and my father certainly has been around it now for 60 years. But my older brother, he's sort of, you know, like I said, the quiet one, the one you don't hear much about. But
And since you bring up the acting part, there's been a discussion about possibly making a movie out of the story. Who do you see playing your father?
Well, I mean, there's certainly a lot of actors I could see right now, wonderful actors that would definitely be able to play the Ed Lucas role. A lot of the people that have read the script, they all know that his story is, you check off every box for winning Best Actor, and it's there. You know, someone overcoming a handicap, someone overcoming prejudice, someone, you know, fighting a battle like my father did to keep his children after they were taken away by the courts. All these things that are, every time you look at the Best Picture winners, Best Actor winners. So there are actors, a lot of them A-list actors, that have been salivating for this project, but it's been narrowed down to one that he's really, really interested. He's in London now doing a show, and I'm technically, even though I'm one of the co-producers of the movie, I'm not allowed to say his name, but it rhymes with Radley Looper. So I give you the hint there. So I didn't say the name. You didn't hear it from me, but you can make your own.
And who do you see playing yourself?
Well, in the movie, the character of me is 9 years old, so they'll get some kid. People always ask, are you going to play you in the movie? And there's lots of things I could do as an actor, but playing 9 years old is a little hard to pull off. So.
Well, they do a wonderful thing with CGI.
Yeah, true.
So this is actually something, there is something set. There is a project in the
movie. It is, yes.
Uh-huh.
It's the
so it's
script
not just a talk anymore. It's a project.
It is. Actually, it's a project long before the book. The script was written back in 2007. Lowell Ganz and Babalu Mandel, who created Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley, and they wrote Splash and A League of Their Own and Fever Pitch and all these classic movies, they got hold of my father's story, and they said, we want to write this, and we want this to be our Oscar winner. We want this to be the movie that people, you know, and they had experience with League of Their Own and other baseball sort of movies that mix baseball and drama. So they really, they put an amazing script together, and it's been circulating around Hollywood now for 8 years. But like everything with Hollywood, it takes a while for the process to go through, and you've got to line up the right director and the right actor. So now that the book has come out, there's been even more attention paid. And now the other problem with Hollywood is money. You know, the studios will not give you the money right now to greenlight. You have to get it from 10 different places to put it all together in one big package. And so money people backed away after 2008. But now that the book has come out and it's been the success that it's been, suddenly the money's flowing back in again. So things will move a lot faster. But as I said, the actor that I cannot name, he who shall not be named, is in London right now doing The Elephant Man, which is yet another hint. But he's got one more movie after that. When he comes back to the States, I think we're shooting sometime later this year, and hopefully it'll be in theaters in 2016.
And what does your dad think of all this newfound fame?
He's coping with it as best. I mean, you know, he knew it was coming. Obviously, he knew the book was going to be out, and people would be paying attention to him. But he's not really comfortable being the story himself. His job is to tell other people's stories. So it's a little interesting. It's strange when you become the focus of it, but he's getting better at it. It's been a couple of weeks. At first, he was kind of reluctant. He didn't want to do too many interviews and all that, but now he's becoming more of a pro at it.
Well, hopefully he'll get more comfortable and used to it as time goes on. Well, we've been talking with Christopher Lucas, author, with his father, Ed Lucas, of Seeing Home, The Ed Lucas Story, a blind broadcaster's story of overcoming life's greatest obstacles, published by Jeter Publishing, imprint of Simon & Schuster. Chris, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
And that was the Bookshelf Conversation with Chris Lucas, co-author with his father, Ed, of Seeing Home, The Ed Lucas Story. Come back again next time when our guest will be Josh Leventhal, the author of The History of Baseball and 100 Objects. And remember, for the latest news, reviews, previews, and interviews, visit Ron Kaplan's BaseballBookshelf.com, and feel free to drop a line or a comment to ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf@gmail.com. Thanks, everybody. See you next time. So grand, he'd have said, boys, I'm glad I discovered this land. Gee, it's a wonder.